The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to the Pritzker Military Library Presents with special guest, Sergeant Major Brian Battaglia. This program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Library in Chicago. It's made possible by members of the library and in collaboration with the Illinois National Guard. This program is a unique opportunity for citizens and citizen soldiers alike to learn about our military and what it takes to keep us the land of the free. Later on, we'll be taking questions from our studio audience and from those of you joining us on the internet at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Brian Battaglia was appointed the second senior enlisted advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in September of 2011. As the most senior non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Armed Forces, he serves as the principal military advisor to the chairman and the Secretary of Defense on all matters involving joint and combined total force integration, utilization, health of the force, and joint development for enlisted personnel. A native of New Orleans, he joined the Marines in 1979, and for more than 32 years, he has served at every level of leadership, ranging from fire team leader, infantry platoon commander, drill instructor, battalion and regimental sergeant major, Royal Marine Exchange, and combatant command. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Library, Sergeant Major Battaglia.
Thanks, everyone, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, sir, for that very, very kind introduction. And so let's get started. There are a few talking points that I'd like to address to both you all physically here and our podcasters that are viewing from afar. And as you can see, they are covered in the slides behind you. And those are the chairman's four priorities, because I firmly believe, as we all know, that if they're the chairman's priorities, and by God, it should be our priorities. So I'd like to cover those with you in general and just touch on primarily one of those. I'd also like to address a thing that we've heard around our force, and that is the term back to the basics. We'll dive a little bit more into that, and we'll have a bit of fun with this, but I'm sure you've heard of the term back to the basics, and I want to try to ask for your assistance in why we need to reshape, if you will, that back to the basics. Not that it is wrong or incorrect, but rather incomplete. And bridging the basics is something that is a little bit more holistic. And then maybe we can finish up with what I believe in rejoining our neighborhoods, or as the chairman calls it, the 21st century veteran. I know that there are small business owners and corporate leadership and employers that are here with us this evening. And so I think it's very important that every time we have the opportunity to brag and boast and advocate for our service members who are transitioning by either retirement or separation from the service and rejoining the neighborhoods throughout our nation, that we again, codify the value and skill sets that they bring to our society. And so I think that's just extremely important, and I will I'll cover that a little bit later. So the chairman's four priorities. Of course, they all read simplistically. They're meant to read that way, ladies and gentlemen, because they need to be understood from the E1 to the O10. And I believe, that not that necessarily that they are listed in priority, i.e. 1 through 4, but rather they all intertwine with one another. Of course, it is complemented by our national military strategy and the strategies of that of the service chiefs as well as the Secretary of Defense. And so while you can see the chairman's priorities here, we can dive into those a little later if you'd like to, the first three, mind you. But what I really wanted to do was to comment on that last one. Now, I don't want you to think that just because it's written last, that it's the least important. And we all know that our commitment to this profession of arms that most of us in this audience have been devoted to for the majority of our adult lives is extremely important. You know, now, not only are we attached to that personally, but we may have sons, daughters, grandchildren. Even as I had the privilege to witness today a recruit graduation of the United States Navy, and in the stands that were just absolutely filled, I mean, from left, right, and center, the bleachers of moms and dads, uncles and aunts and siblings, and it just refreshed me that our nation is really in good hands with the quality of recruits that we're still continuing to train and educate. So the chairman wants us to, each and every one of us, to renew our commitment to the profession of to our profession of arms. So what does that really mean? And I thought about that as I took a moment to reflect, and then I realized that, you know, I renew my commitment quite often. And I'll share some tidbits that I try to use, and I certainly welcome you, those in the military, to use them as well. But the oath of enlistment is the one tool that I automatically refer to as an enlisted. You know, when I took over this position a year and a half ago, how could you turn down an assignment or a request by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to come serve in the Pentagon and represent literally 2.3 million enlisted men and women and their families? How could you really do that? You know, that was one piece of it. The other piece, of course, is it shows that General Dempsey does in fact still have a sense of humor by hiring someone like me to come up to Washington, D.C. and take on that sort of responsibility. But that's not the first time he and I have worked together. And so I think that, I happened to build a little credibility and sort of made a name that I would in fact fulfill this job to the best of my ability. And that's just another extension of the profession as you and I take on different jobs and roles as we move throughout our career. But the oath of enlistment, you know, this oath, this paragraph has been around since the late 1700s. And there are some very special things in this oath that I really appreciate. Now, most service members don't really remember the oath that they took in the MEP station. You know, they're just planted sort of in a mass group before a commissioned officer or a warrant and asked to raise their right hand and read something off or repeat after me, and that's the extent of it, you know. And the delayed entry program happens and goes into basic training, and there are other things within our services that become more important, if you will, or more visible and used more because of our service culture. And it could be the Airman's Creed, the Soldier's Creed, and things of that nature. And while those are very, very important and have direct linkage into our profession, I believe the oath has an historical and traditional linkage because of how long it's been around, because of from the most senior NCO standing before you in our armed forces to the most junior service member that's either here in the audience or viewing in from podcast, that oath reads identically the same. Now, we know there are some differences between the oath that a guardsman takes and an oath that an active component, but it's minute. And the message is clear, the message is still there. And that's what I use to renew my commitment to this profession of arms. I really take the oath so serious that I feel strongly every enlisted service member in our armed forces should know their enlistment oath by heart and on demand. And how a privilege it must be for a commissioned or warrant officer to be able to administer the oath to a soldier, a Marine, a sailor, an airman, a Coast Guardsman. I mean, you know, and just as you reflect and read the words that are on the screen, they're pretty powerful. And it doesn't take long to realize that no other profession, career path, job that our country offers, and maybe the closest that could ever come would be policemen and firemen, but no other job, not with J.P. Morgan and Chase, not joining the payroll as in Ford Motor Company, Sears and Roebuck, any Fortune 500 company or small business would require you to join their payroll and have to take an oath of that magnitude to support and defend the Constitution of the United States at all costs. And our men and women this day in the all-volunteer force continue to join to include the 700 and some odd that I helped graduate this morning from the United States Navy. And they're joining at a time when our nation, of course, is still in conflict. Doesn't that say wonders about their character? And so I just wanted to relay to you that we're in good hands. We really are. I had another way that I used to renew the oath that I wanted to share, but I recently found a third way. And I hope this resonates with you all as well. I visited New York City not that long ago, just last month. And it was my first time ever visiting New York City, especially since September 11th of 2001, and that day. And I found myself a very emotional time. Now, I went up for business, of course, to do some interviews and some activity with the guard there. And part of that visit, though, was to see the memorials. Now, there were individuals who were pre-assigned to kind of take me through as a tour guide, and some of those happened to be widows of firemen or policemen who, you know, died and passed in the rubble that morning. And while that was very, very emotional, I just think as a service member who has deployed, as many of you have, into either theaters of war or even supporting this global war on terrorism from afar, visiting those sites in New York City where it really all began, right, really answered some questions for me. It provided closure, if you will, and I just found myself reflecting in the moment of standing there where buildings used to be, or people used to be, you know, socializing, and very moved and taken aback that at one time this place was very, very different, and my deployments overseas mean much, much more. The sacrifices away from my family mean much, much more. There was never any question in my mind as to fulfilling my duties and obligations, of course. And again, this is not all about me. I don't want you to capture that in here. But I just found that visit to New York City and where it all started really provided some closure, some answers, if you will. Not that I was looking for answers of unanswered questions, but it did wonders for me. And I offer that to you as well as another method to fulfill the chairman's direction that we renew our commitment to the profession of arms. So as I mentioned in the beginning, ladies and gentlemen, the term back to the basics. It's a catchy little phrase. I've even used it, you know, and when I did and said to the sergeant, "Hey, sergeant, we're going back to the basics." The sergeant said to me, "Whose basics? Sergeant Major, yours?" I have no idea what those basics are. As a matter of fact, are my basics that jacked up that we need to return to your basics? And it was sort of an aha V8 moment for me. Let me explain a little further and bear with me. What the term back to the basics was implied initially to mean, I think, and now I don't know who coined it, and I'm not saying, again, it's wrong. I would certainly shake the hand of the individual who invented it, but I'm just here to tell you that it may be a little incomplete and not necessarily holistic. As we downsized in Iraq and troops started coming back, and we are now downsizing in Afghanistan, which we'll talk a little bit about as well, 68,000 now, 34,000 this time next year, and then by December of 14, we'll fold the flag there as the plan goes. When those troops return, we're going to find ourselves, possibly if we're not in any other conflict, back in a heavily laden garrison environment. okay? You know, garrison. And so that garrison environment is something very, very strange to today's generation for the most part, because they've been the back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and haven't really had a sustained period in a garrison-like environment like some of our generation has, right? I'm looking at ages out there. This doesn't apply to any women. I'm looking at ages out there, and I see some of you all that, you know, are my age, and you can relate to this as I joined in 79. And as you know, we came into the military training for a war we never fought, right? The Cold War. And we had a lot of time in garrison. Sure, there were peacetime deployments and operational exercises and maybe some smaller excursions throughout the years, but for the most part, it was garrison life. And we really cracked the code. We knew how to survive in this garrison kind of life, right? It was filled with things that were maybe more administrative than they were tactical, because we didn't have the back and forth, as today's generation did. So when they are now going to experience what we lived and learned how to survive in, some of my, you know, kind of peer group and senior leaders are very concerned that the methods of operating and the garrison, you know, heaviness with this generation is going to cause some problems. And so that's where the term came. We're going to go back to the basics. We're going to generate and give CPR to some of these basics and methods of operating that we know worked. So that's where the term came from. And I'm here to tell you that I don't think back to the basics again is the most holistic sort of definition, and bridging the basics is. Because as a sergeant told me, are our basics that jacked up to where we have to return to yours, tells me that we're sort of looking at this generation as part of the problem. Rather, we should be looking at them as part of the solution. Let me give you an example if I can. There was there are some basics that I grew up with I wouldn't want to take this generation back to be quite honest with you. You know, and we have a generation of today that is just extremely innovative, both in mind and technology. We can use that to our advantage. The Army is real big now on going back to the basics as well as the Corps. The Army used to use a technique, method of operating called the Unit Leader's Notebook. Does that ring a bell with anybody? The Unit Leader's Notebook. Now, this was a sheet of paper, kind of heavy cardboard paper, where you had all the personal information written about every one of your soldiers or Marines, and it had children, where they went to school, everything, because it was extremely important that you knew your soldier, you knew your Marine. We lost that, right? Because we got so busy, we took that practice, shelved it, and now we're living in the back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and we kind of lost touch with who they are as well as who we are. So back to the basics, the Army wants to go with the Unit Leader Notebook. Anyway, there's a promotion board taking place one day. This is a true story. Enjoy the laugh if you find it humorous. But there was a promotion board going one day, Army promotion board, and this is when the young enlisted comes up and he or she presents herself before this panel, and then the panel of the first sergeant, right, and the command sergeant major grill this soldier up one side and down the other to see if they pass the test as to are they kind of eligible and meet the standard for promotion. So the sergeant comes up, this was sergeant to staff sergeant, and reports into this command sergeant major, a crusty looking guy, right? And he's got the first sergeants here. And the sergeant reports in, and the command sergeant major says, "All right, let me see your unit leader notebook." Remember, this was the old, the three-ring binder, right, that had 33 cards, because the sergeant was a platoon sergeant, so he had 33 cards of all his platoon members. And when he said, "Let me see your unit leader notebook," the sergeant had it. The sergeant had the unit leader notebook. Today's generation sergeant. And he handed it over to the command sergeant major. Now, it wasn't a three-ring binder, it was an iPad. and that's sort of when the deer in the headlight look took place, because the CSM was a bit clueless as to now how to navigate and maneuver the iPad to download the PDF of all those 33 cards, right, and expand them out and send them off any way you want to, but everything was here, right? And what initially went out to be a promotion board, again, true story, winded up being a small little mini professional military education of the sergeant coming around the table and educating the CSM how to maneuver and navigate this iPad. Because it had everything that the unit leader notebook, the old traditional brick and mortar thick thing, had. And so, I'd be remiss not to say who got promoted during that session, right? But I think the more important moral of the story is that just days later, the command sergeant major was seen with his very own iPad. You know, and again, it was a old tactic and technique and method of operating. With today's technology and innovation, bridged, and voila. And that's the bridging the basics piece instead of just completely going back to that. I don't think we can completely go back to basics because, all the basics, if you will, because one, it would be a setback for us. Two, there's literally some, we have to, as an older group, have to set our ego aside, if you will, because there's some catching up that we have to do with today's technology. And three, we would never be able to keep pace with our adversary if we went too far back to some basics. So that was one example. And in the essence of time, let me move on. And if there is time on the end, I'll give you another example that should bring you a few laughs as well. But I'm on a promotion reshaping kind of venture right now to say that, while, again, back to the basics is not incompletely or incorrect, I just think it's incomplete, and we can reshape it to bridge the basics instead of going completely back to. Speaking about bridging the basics, let me sort of close up with this. Because at some point in time, all of you in uniform in the audience, this transition will take place. For our guardsmen, this takes place every time they return from deployment. And reservists as well when they demobilize. So this is nothing new to this audience. Some already sitting in a coat and tie out in the audience have went through this process. And it's a very trying time to be uncertain and fear the unknown as to how I am really going to transition and the comfort of being successful. We have a responsibility in our military as leaders. One, we take America's sons and daughters from parents, and they join this all-volunteer force, and we take them places even in harm's way, and to fulfill a mission assigned by our commanders through the SecDef, through the President of the United States. And that's an important mission in of itself, right? To complete that mission and bring everyone as best we can back safe and sound. This obviously is applicable to that, with maintaining and defending freedom sometimes comes a price. And so our veterans, as they transition, or our service members as they transition, we certainly owe it to them as well as to our society that we properly prepare them as best we can to fill the other half of that mission. And that's returning our service members as veterans back into society as productive members thereof. I'm sort of embarrassed as a senior leader than at that time probably a more mid-grade or junior leader. I'm part of this problem, and I'm ashamed to admit, but it is what it is, that during the course of a service member nearing his or her end of enlistment, I didn't see it at that time how important it was to get an early start on thinking about transitioning. what was more important for me was the mission. And so as an infantry person, if I had Marines who were transitioning out of the service and had, you know, 3 months or so left, hey, that was at least 2 months of field time that I could get out of them, right? I know I'm not the only one who thought that way or still thinks that way, but that's the wrong approach. I'm happy to announce that, and some of you may know this, that we as a Department of Defense have done a complete overhaul with our transition programs. And we start earlier, because when we fail to properly prepare our service members, that leads to things like homelessness, to unemployment. That's not strange to any metropolitan city or even smaller suburb in the United States, Chicago included. Although I think Chicago does very, very well with its homeless and unemployment per capita. But until we reach those numbers of that number of zero, we all have work to do. To beat homelessness, of course, you know our president has directed and demanded that by 2015 we take all of our homeless veterans off the streets. And we're working hard to do that. But I think it's our problem, not the VA's problem, everyone's problem. If we do it right on the front end while they're still in uniform, it will be less work that the VA has to do on the back end. So, you know, while we are trained, molded, and developed as problem solvers, I think we can do a better job with our service members if we all seek to become problem preventers. Now, I know some of this is personality driven of our service members, you know, taking it on their own to properly prepare themselves. But we didn't do it right. It was more of a check in the box. So I am happy to announce, and this is in concert with Department of Labor and the VAL Act, and how we have really taken a serious look at not just officer and enlisted, but specialties within our services. And have deemed things like the 11 Bravo infantry soldier, the 0311 infantry Marine, may be in a little more higher risk group and may need some other things to help him or her, for that matter, transition out or prepare them to transition. I visited San Diego since I've been in office, and that there was a homeless center. I walked in to the director, and he was an older veteran himself, I believe previously homeless. And Sergeant Major, please sit down. We took a small brief, and then he said the average age of my 72-man homeless center here in San Diego, the average age is 44. Now, even Louisiana math can figure out that 44 is quite young, huh? Most of my thinking of homeless was Vietnam veteran age. And I quickly found out that that wasn't necessarily the case, not nowadays. So just minutes later, the director took me down into, and some of the staff was there as well with me, into a room that I was surrounded by 10 to 15 veterans, OIF, OEF, and OND had not happened yet, but that age group of veterans. Today's generation, right? The innovative, tech savvy. And I was speechless. I was just literally blown away. But then, you know, came the gentlemen and ladies, because there was a female service member there. Let me really, you know, pull off my rank insignia here, and because I really need to know how this could occur. We don't teach this, not in basic training, not anywhere else in our service curriculum do we teach that you would ever become, you know, and put in places like this. And there was some whining and wooing, but one young man, and what really made it personal for me is one of my corpsmen that I served with in Fallujah was sitting there right in front of me, homeless. And so it was another aha moment. Of course, part of the reason for this overhaul of the transition programs, the TAPs and the ACAPs. But the young man said to me, "Sergeant Major, you know, you all do such a great job on the front end with recruiting us in. I wish I'd only reciprocated on the back end of preparing us to get out." And that's what woke me up of going back to my first sergeant days, you know, of telling Marines, what, you got a month left? I can get 2 weeks out of you in the field. You don't need but 3 days to completely, you know, check. And it was just, you know, very linear thinking. So our veterans now go into a process at least a year out. And I say this because part of this pitch is knowing that some business owners inside the room here is I hope you realize that hiring a veteran is a great investment. And while he or she may possess special skill sets that may or may not be completely compatible to what you're looking for in the job description, it's a risk worth taking, I think. You're getting someone from coming from the world's greatest profession in my eyes. And I say that unbiasedly. Again, if we did our job as best as we could on the front end, we could prevent a lot on the back end. Now, when a service member, as you may know or not, cannot find a job upon separation and files for unemployment, compensation is, of course, paid. And that compensation comes from the service's budget. I jotted down some stats I can entertain you with. The numbers are not impressive at all. This is just over a 3-month period. But just for example, in 1 quarter, 3 months worth of, the Army paid out over $3 million. This is in the state of Illinois only. The Navy, $1.5 million, Air Force, $511,000, Coast Guard, $35,000 over a quarter period. I think the Marine Corps is just below the Navy. And that happens in all metropolitan cities. So if that's money that we could be using in other places, right? Because we are presently in this fiscal cellar right now and are trying to find ways to get us out of it. And the formula is easy. You either invest the monies up front by properly preparing to the best of your ability, or in unemployment compensation, you pay for it on the back end. I think, of course, as you know, as all intelligent Americans as we are, we're going to invest it on the front end. So that's the switch in thinking we really want to take. Our service members transitioning now are going to be taught either, if they show a desire that they may want to go back to college, we want to set them up in some new ways, because we know that while the interest and desire may be there, sometimes the adjustment is not. And there's problems that come with that. The interest in the fire can be there, but the adjustment is not, if that makes sense. So we have found that student veterans associations are very, very helpful to us in helping service members get full use of the GI Bill by, and not going to college, finding that it wasn't really for them by the environment that they're now associated with, of the compatibility sake, and then they wind up dropping out. There are service members who have expressed an interest in entrepreneurship, even opening up their own business. Service members getting out together that have met, you know, somewhere during a tour and want to get out and open up a business together with their battle buddy, if you will. And so there's a magic and science to that. We never before we've had that, but we teach them now how to open up their own business. And then there are service members who just want to join the workforce, and we start that R form. Some, you know, there was so much emphasis on resume writing and how to wear a suit or a dress for an interview. It voided focus from other, and this is the old traditional way. It voided focus in other ways that we should have been paying attention to. Some service members don't need to know how to fill out a resume, but rather just an application. And so we're going to tailor the needs of our men and women more so than just have some standard check in the blocks, you know, plunk it down and here it gets taught. People are going to be held responsible. So those employees that come out from the Department of Labor who have a responsibility by legislation to teach these various classes to our service members are going to be held to task. And I've seen that already. So I'm very, very proud to announce that. It's in its latter pilot stages. It's being implemented in bases, and it grows each and every day. And we're going to see some some positive vibes in that with regard to service members transitioning out of the service with a lot more confidence. Of course, the end state is before they ever leave uniform is to have them hired. And I'm hoping that will be a norm more so than few and far between. Okay, let me stop right there. I think that's probably the best. And just close with this, and then we'll open up some questions and answers if you all may have. As I said earlier, we have an obligation as officers and as non-commissioned officers that when we take the sons and daughters of America's parents, we mold them, we develop them, we use them, we enrich them, we mature them. But we also must return them to become productive members of society. That is our complete mission as leaders in this profession of arms. And I'm proud to say that while we haven't done a good job of it, we will here in the very, very future. So employers and business owners, those 300 and some odd thousand service members who routinely separate from our armed forces each and every year are looking for work. I can help you find them. They're out there, and it's a great investment for you, both lucratively and career-wise. Okay, so thank you for listening to me, and how about we take a break and certainly open up for some questions and answers.
George Mulvaney with the Marine Corps Coordinating Council of Chicago. Welcome to Chicago, sir.
Thank you.
It's a two-part question. Number one, transitioning service, military service members, coming back from OIF, OEF. The problem with the TAPS program is not working. You're familiar, sir, with the Marine for Life program. We have a great one here in Chicago. The transitioning military service personnel, beautiful resume. They get an assistance. It looks great. They get up in front of the employer and they say, I'm an 0311 and that's all I do, and right. I'm a team leader. I fire a weapon. Employers don't like to actually hear that.
Sure.
And yet, you know, you look at their resume and they've been everywhere, they've done everything, but our problem is the resume is being assisted. But when they're going through the TAPS program, we do what we did yesteryear, like you say, bridging what we've done years before, mm-hmm. the cattle car. We always, from Camp Pendleton, threw us in the cattle car, threw us up to the rifle range, and that's all we done. The TAPS program is exactly the same thing. You're running these military service members through the cattle car, you know, pushing them in there, and you're saying, okay, they're transitioning out. I remember when I separated out of Camp Pendleton, the same thing. Nothing was said. Nothing was said about, you know, jobs or anything,
right.
Availability. The other question of the second part was the transitioning of the five-year, we have to, what, downsize by 100,000 plus. Now we're going to take that 100,000 plus service members, Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, within the next 5 years, push them into the job market. And yet, we don't have any jobs for these. Hiring Our Heroes, which is under the Chamber of Commerce, uh-huh. The director there is retired Colonel Marine, says, our problem with Hiring Our Heroes is we have double-digit numbers more than the national average for unemployment for military service members. And I believe when he says double-digit, in the age group of 18 to 21, well, it probably wasn't 18, it was probably 21 to 24, and then he mm-hmm. gave the, you know, the digits and everything.
Right.
Our problem is corporate America, like you say, J.P. Morgan and everybody, is saying that we're hiring 100,000 plus. He's saying it's not really 100,000. We've only hired 34,000. So corporate America is doing a media blast on what they're doing, and then the military service on the other side of the page is saying the real numbers are like this. So I'd like to find out if we could, we got the congresswoman in here too, and say, how can we best do the TAPS program, the VRAP, which is for the Vietnam Veteran Program, a better service for them and the transitioning veterans of today. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. By the way, you know, talking about the cattle car, you're really showing your age.
2 years
prior to you, sir. Well, the Marine for Life concept or methodology here is resonating amongst the other branches of the service. Matter of fact, General Dempsey would love nothing more than to make this service member for life. And he talks about the total force, right? And again, this is not about him or I, but the total force is a large community. It comes from the military child who's, you know, just an infant to now grown up, maybe in high school and is a member of the ROTC, to the service member, to the spouse, to the 80-year-old veteran who's a lifelong member to the American Legion. It's, you know, cradle to grave. It's from inception to interment. That's the total force, and that's what we want. We want, just because they transition out of uniform and now belong to the VA at 80 years old, we still want that individual feeling airman. And that's the Marine for Life kind of concept, because it's never let go. I see that happening more and more day in and day out. So it's spreading the Marine for Life methodology to others. I went and sat with the First Lady, her executive assistant, and described some skepticism with regard to, it was just the executive assistant. My wife had sat with the First Lady. But I was skeptical about the 100,000 jobs as well. And what I think was happening here, and it's not to dupe anyone, I believe, it's just about hiring. And so it wasn't necessarily hiring those who were unemployed. It may have been folks who are already employed looking to advance or move up into another job, which created a vacancy somewhere else, but it still got counted as a job. And so companies or corporations were reaching that magical number, patting themselves on the back, saying, hey, we look what we did, 10,000, where it only may have been 7,500. I wasn't going to get wrapped around the antics of that, but the numbers may not be so accurate. And while it was still making jobs or providing paychecks to families, the numbers may have been off a little bit. I'll remind them again next time we happen to meet. And what was another part of your question? Oh, the
$100,000 reduction in
force. Yeah. So allow me just to touch on that a few minutes. We doing okay on time? Now, even without sequestration, ladies and gentlemen, you know that there's some reshaping that happens after every major conflict, right? We did it in Vietnam, Korea, World War II. It's just natural. That's the evolution, the reset, refit, reshape of our force. And as the gentleman announced, again, now what I'm talking without sequestration, the Army was going to downsize by, 90,000 or so. And General Odierno had testified not that long ago to say that in light of sequestration, that 90,000 may in fact increase. And we're just waiting to see the rest of the fallout and residual as to more exact numbers of how the Army is going to shape into this Joint Force 2020 vision, as you've seen the chairman's number two priority. The Marine Corps was going to downsize by about 20,000. And the Air Force and the Navy have been doing pretty good over the years. Now that 90 and 20,000 respectively from the Army and the Marines, that was going to be over the course of 5 or 6 years, incrementally done. And officer enlisted various specialties just to rebalance the force. We are going to strengthen up a little bit in a couple of areas around the forces. One is Special Operations Forces. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that just because we completely come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, well, not completely, but almost completely, that our adversaries can go away. That's not going to happen. There's going to be folks that still need to be eliminated. You know what special operators do. And so we're going to increase that capability just a little bit by about 3,500 was the last number I received. That's unclassified information, of course. And then cyber is another area where we're going to build a little bit more robustness. You know the threat. I mean, you may have felt it in your own organizations. It's not just in the military, but it's in society writ large, right? Our financial institutions are always in high threat, if you will. And so we want to defend, be able to defend that in a comfortable way where we don't wind up like some other nations who didn't exhaust every effort to increase their cyber shields. And so that's kind of the layout of the services. Now, the question may come up based on some recent articles. Well, how's the Guard? I heard the Guard and the Reserve was going to be put back on a shelf after we all come back. That was a recent article written, I believe, in the Army Times. And let's see, I don't know if it's one word or two words, but hogwash. That's what I got to say about that. Our National Guard is here to stay, and so are the reserves. And by God, I'm going to tell you, as a deployed Marine myself who have had both of those elements, all seven elements of our RC, I'll be the first to tell you publicly that we have could have not sustained ourselves as an armed force in Iraq or Afghanistan over the last decade plus without the commitment, devotion, deployment, and sacrifice of both the Guard and the Reserve. There's just no way we could have done that. And I'm proud to say that. In a lot of cases, I'll tell you this, and it's not against my own active component, if you will, but the Guard and the Reserve bring more capability in a lot of cases than the active component does. I say that proudly, and in fact, you know, they know that as well. Employers. We made an effort, I believe back in 2005, to educate society, mainly employers, with regard to post-traumatic stress. We have a tendency in the military to lean too forward. And we really educated, all right, because after we flooded, I think, society writ large, this was under Admiral Mullen's administration, and we needed to do it, we swung the pendulum a little too far to the left. Because what happened and transpired was that all of our employers were thinking every service member getting out of their service had post-traumatic stress. And that's not the case at all. And I'll tell you this, that post-traumatic stress is not something that's just combat related. You know, you'd be surprised at how many six-digit figured, you know, veterans that are really well off have post-traumatic stress and have never deployed. And you know, the stories will go on and on and on. So it's a very, very manageable. I have it. I don't call it a disorder. I think it's an injury. Well, I know I joined the military, so there's a slight disorder there to begin with. but I really consider it to be an injury that's very treatable. And I would not like someone. Now, I know that probably the scientific or medical or technical term needs to have disorder. But nonetheless, we're trying to swing the pendulum back a little bit the other way now and rebalance it that our employers and corporate leadership out in society know that not everybody does have post-traumatic stress or mental issues, and it's okay to hire a veteran. It's a great investment. Just needed to pass that because that was a problem there. Okay.
Next question is going to be upstairs.
Okay.
Good evening, Sergeant Major.
Good evening.
My name is Master Gunnery Sergeant Velasquez. I'm a vet from Marine Force Pacific, as well as a member of the Chicago Police Marine Corps League. I just got back from Korea, and I'm trying to find out, do you know any updates on that tuition assistance? I know they had stopped it for the young hard chargers, and I just need to know if there's any updates on that.
Okay, that's a great question, tuition assistance. I addressed this twice today at some other speaks, and so you could tell it's really the flavor of the month, if you will, because it's so important. Master Guns, you look about my age, right? Young and vibrant. And so when you joined, tuition assistance may have not even been a word, much less an acronym. And it became a benefit established, 25%, then 50%, then 100%, you know, and that's where we are now. So we were able, because we had things, we were able to build that for our men and women over the course of years to provide some sort of supplement in off-duty education. And folks were able to pursue, you know, degrees, and it's worked out great. We're in this fiscal cellar now. Right, and even without sequestration, we had a $487 billion debt that we're going to have to pay back over the course of 10 years. Now, we had a plan for that, but there were some shavings and savings that just had to take place. And some of that was going to come out of benefits more than entitlements. And that's what tuition assistance is it's a benefit. I think over the course of the years, our recruiting commands have, you know, led, not duping, if you will, but they themselves came in at a time where they thought that tuition assistance was in fact entitlement because that's what they were told. Now they went on recruiting, obviously assuming that it too was an entitlement, and so it became a norm. you know, that it was automatic that you were getting tuition assistance and 100% of it when you joined the forces. Now, education is important. It's a great, you know, selling tool. Again, not getting duped. And so when the news came out, of course, it caused a bit of ruckus. I took some shrapnel over it, you know, and rightfully so. That's okay, because that's part of my job is allowing the enlisted to come back at me, and even the retired community, and allow me to serve as a voice. But this issue went to the White House very, very quick. So I say this to say this. Because the Army, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard quickly came out with that benefit, suspension of it, not cancellation, right? It was just suspension of that benefit. The Navy did not. The Navy works under a little better kind of scrutiny of how they award tuition assistance to its sailors. Because this comes out of the services budgets, right? They made the decision, those service chiefs, that we're going to take this benefit and suspend it. That's going to save us some money instead of dipping into an entitlement. What's an entitlement? Our pay and compensation. And that you don't want to mess with in a service member's pay. I even fought, you know, very, very hard to leave that untouched. And tuition assistance, the initial numbers, didn't really codify that we could easily justify tuition assistance was being used to a degree that it was an easy sell to someone to say, don't touch it. Look how it's being utilized. The numbers weren't that great. Now, though, since it was a benefit that has been threatened to be taken away or suspended, it's become a hot stock. And everybody wants it now. So it's even gained in popularity. But I don't want you to think, ladies and gentlemen, that the service chiefs, those four service chiefs, kind of sold you short, because that's not it at all. Matter of fact, they're just the other way. They're trying to protect. Again, it's a benefit, not an entitlement, you know, and it still is. So Congress has directed to come back across the river into the Pentagon for the service chiefs to reinstate the tuition assistance. Now it's you know, we're just trying to find the money. Where in the service budget are you going to take it from to make the tuition assistance kind of, you know, active again? And some of the services have not found that to this point. Where do you take it from? You can't even call it a zero-sum game anymore. So the services will find some answers pretty soon because they've been directed by Congress. I hope that satisfies.
Yes,
coming to the theater near you.
Sergeant Major, I was going to ask you, and you've kind of directed John Scully. You are the advisor to the Secretary of the Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. What are the senior enlisted telling their chiefs about the morale of the soldiers, the Marines, as we're in sequestration? I frankly am concerned that we're going to end up as we did at the end of World War II, and we get ourselves another Task Force Smith in Korea, and we get a hollow army as we did when I left Vietnam and joined the Army Reserve and was given an old rifle that was absolutely useless. We've made our services the best in the country, or best in the world. I'm concerned that we're going to have a hollow army, a hollow Marine Corps in the next 5 years, and I just wonder how you're advising the chiefs to deal with that issue.
Thanks, General. Great question. I don't know how the service senior enlisted advise their service chiefs. We're going to have a collective meeting actually this Monday that General Dempsey is going to come and sit on, and we're going to talk about some of those very issues. So I wish I was here next week. Maybe I can answer a little more thoroughly than I'm asking. My advice, though, to more so General Dempsey, I've not talked to Secretary Hagel about this yet. I have an appointment coming up with him, and of course he's concerned, as well as the other leaders. My reply to them when asked about morale is mixed. There are some that are happy and content. Content, I say that loosely, because there is that degree of uncertainty everybody has, and we don't like the fear of the unknown. But are confident in their leadership that we're going to get us. We'll get them through this. There's concern about the lack of funding will have to will affect impact modernization, and that's going to cause us to have to get a little innovative and possibly go back to some older ways or different ways that doesn't use, such as pilots maintaining currency. And JP-8 being expensive as it is, pilots are very well likely to find themselves doing more simulator time than actual flying time, so the currency rules may in fact have to change a little bit. Will it change their level of proficiency and the bands of excellence go down? I don't think so. I'd still feel comfortable with flying them because I know their commitment. But again, it would be in a simulator more so than in the air, thereby saving the gas. As an infantry guy, I can remember the days where I went to the field for a whole week on maneuvers and received one box of blank ammo for a whole week. And the advice that was given by my squad leader was, yeah, and don't use it all in one attack. That's not advice. But the modeling and simulation back then was once you ran out of the ammo was butter jam. That was the innovation in modeling and simulation back in the early 80s. And of course, we have like EST 2000s nowadays and all that high-tech modeling and sim that we will have to use because the brick and mortar may not be there like the live ammunition. And then the advanced stage of that and this is a part of the concern as well, because we're going back in time. And when we go back in time like that, it's still effective. We can still maintain readiness. We did it back then. We're confident. There's some bridging, though, that still needs to, I think, take place. The Guard sees it. I know you do, because you deal with state partnership. And when you go over to places like Poland, whose military may not be as modernized as ours, and you have to take a step back in time, this is where the Guard really pays off. You know how to teach because with their capabilities or lack thereof, because they don't have them and you lived it, compared to maybe an active component unit that always only has younger generation. So they're going to show up with iPads and iPods, and it's not going to be compatible with that method of training. So the maintaining readiness is certainly a concern of mine. But the overall answer on morale is mixed.
I work on a day-to-day basis with veterans here in Illinois, and I appreciate you bringing up all those issues that are facing our transitioning service members. When General Shinseki took over about 4.5 years ago, one of his priorities was to have the VA talk better with DOD. And now you have talked about how the TAPS is being revamped and we're transitioning our service members better. Can you talk how TAPS and DOD in general are planning to work better with the VA moving forward in that transition process?
You may have to explain that a little differently.
There's historically been a problem with DOD not talking well with the VA, and that's where some of the benefits have fallen through the cracks. Yeah. And younger servicemen or members, when they're transitioning, don't know about a lot of the benefits that the VA offers them. And part of that has been the lack of knowledge during the TAPS, and as you've mentioned, the rushing through of TAPS.
Yeah.
So is there anything that DOD is doing in this revamping to better educate and better?
Yeah, got it. Yeah. In short, yes. Because we're making it mandatory for some of the things that the service members used to just be voluntary for in their transitioning process are now mandatory. It will be mandatory that a service member starts at least a year out. Every good commander that makes kind of a campaign plan or an op order, when that goes into execution, that commander, no more than 2 days later is already thinking of an exit strategy, right? Why don't we do that with, now I know that's too early, because at that point in time, the sailor doesn't even know how to spell Navy, right? So you got to let the sailor nurture over time. But a year out from his or her separation of service, regardless of whether they decided to reenlist or not, is time. That's going to be the threshold there. So they'll start being cued into all over the course of that whole year. Now, they're not taken out of the unit and put into some kind of transition unit, but there's VA benefits all throughout there. Education and learning, some computer-based, some brick and mortar, and it all ends in a capstone event that the commanding officer is going to be held responsible for. And that capstone event goes into those three avenues of which way they decide to go, whether it be school, entrepreneurship, or just the workforce. Or in fact, that may scare them enough to where they want to in fact re-enlist, right? So we got mandatory things in place that helps them, you know, save from themselves. And it also helps the commander as well. I hope it becomes an inspectable item, you know, that part of it, when the IG of that service comes around to inspect the unit.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Sergeant Major Battaglia, thank you. We'll do more Q&A after this. Our thanks to Sergeant Major Brian Battaglia for joining us. Special thanks to members of the Pritzker Military Library and the Illinois National Guard for making this program possible. You become a member of the library, learn more about it, download this audio podcast and others, or view other archives programs at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Join us next time on Pritzker Military Library Presents. Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the library. The Pritzker Military Library Presents is made possible by members of the library and its sponsors. If you would like to be a part of our studio audience or learn more, visit PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.